This is AutoLine After Hours with Peter DiLorenzo, Episode 7 for Thursday, May 14th, 2009, Peter's Principles.
Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Music Store.
Okay, here we are. Welcome. Joining me tonight is David Welch from Business Week. David,
evening, folks.
David, what's up?
How's it going, man?
It's going good, man. And of course, Jason Vines. I want everyone to notice that Jason is wearing an Auto Extremist hat, which I gave him tonight because I got sick of looking at the Auto Week hat. And then we have Eddie Alterman, the man who has taken over Car and Driver, who's Skyped in.
Yeah.
What's up, Eddie?
What's up, man? From the basement, Skyping in.
The basement, undisclosed location.
We see you, buddy. We see you.
All right, so, boy, you know, we keep saying, are we going to run out of things to talk about? And, of course, lately in the auto business, we never will. Jason, why don't you start us off? What do you think about the Chrysler dealers closing?
Had to be done. Painful. When we, a few of us, and you were out there on the web saying, Congress, President, please give a damn about this industry. We talked about the impact of the dealers and the community and how this isn't a Michigan problem, this isn't a Detroit problem. We're seeing it today as these dealers close throughout the nation by June 9th, as it looks like. It's going to really hurt communities. That's the bad news. The good news is it had to be done. The company, as Ford, as GM, was trying to contract their dealer body, had to do it. The benefit of this, sadly, the good news in all this is that the bankruptcy court for Chrysler allows them to do this without much fear of reprisal. Some of the dealers will try to file lawsuits. I don't think they'll amount to a hill of beans, and Chrysler will get down to a reasonable dealer body. We're seeing that most of the dealers that are going away are Chrysler Jeep only or Dodge only. They have dual franchises where they're with a Ford dealership or a Hyundai dealership or a Buick GMC dealership, so they're not going to be totally out of business. But this allows the Chrysler body, when the new Chrysler Fiat comes through, to have a chance. They're not out of the woods, but yeah, they have a chance.
What do you think, Taylor?
Well, first part about what Jason is saying, it has a big impact on communities, and it really does, because dealers, you know, they're different than a lot of other small businesses in that these guys sponsor the local Little League teams and Kiwanis clubs and all that sort of thing, particularly in the small towns. Fewer of those small town dealers are going away than really urban dealers, but it is going to have an impact. They employ people, and they're sort of an anchor of a lot of communities, actually. But you just couldn't go on with dealerships that were selling, you know, 300 or 500 cars a year when Toyota's got dealerships selling 1,400 cars a year. The dealerships are more profitable. You know, the import dealerships, they can take care of their customers better. They can cut deals. The big three, or I should say, GM and Chrysler, as they get rid of these dealers, their dealers, well, I think, will be better able to hold price because they're not competing with a guy two or three blocks away. Now the challenge here is keeping all the market share, and I think this will be an issue because there are some customers who are loyal to a dealer or salespeople. Mm-hmm. And when that's gone, they may still like your vehicle, but you give them another reason to shop someplace else. You know, in the same way that if you kill off a brand, say, you know, even though there aren't that many Saturn buyers relative to the market, you kill off Saturn, they're not going to just necessarily go to General Motors. You've given them a reason to go shop somewhere else. So you'll see some of that in some of these communities where, you know, people were loyal to a particular dealer because the dealer did a good job. And also, there's going to be a smaller retail presence, even though some of the dealers going away only had one brand. And they're just smaller presence on the street. So I think there will be some, you know, some issues holding the market share. You know, but as always, it's in how they execute it and, you know, how they do things to try to keep those customers.
Yeah. Eddie, do you have anything to add on this?
A comment and a question. I was talking to a guy that I know in commercial real estate, And he said that the really damaging thing to the communities is that most dealerships are sited on the most expensive piece of property in town. And when that goes away, so does the entire price structure for commercial real estate in that town. So I thought that was sort of an interesting insight.
Yeah.
My question is, with fewer dealers, do they increase in power? Does the dealer body actually get stronger because they're carrying more weight? And isn't that the problem to begin with?
In terms of political power?
Well, the tail is sort of wagging the dog and has been in terms of product development with the domestics for a very, very long time. The problem with Pontiac, you could argue, is that they wanted a minivan too. And are we strengthening the dealer body or are we weakening it? What's going to happen to the franchise laws? I think those are questions that I'd like to, investigate, find the answer out to.
Wow.
Well, good. You do that on your own time, Eddie.
You can't tell me.
Just kidding. Well, there's so many layers to that. What you just said.
I'm multi-layered. I'm like an onion, Peter.
Oh, okay. Well, I've been writing about too many dealers, too many models, too many divisions since I started writing about auto extremists. So ultimately, yes, this had to happen. But an interesting little sidebar to this is, people took great umbrage of us, us people being in this linked to this industry because they said, well, Detroit doesn't matter, you're irrelevant, all that stuff. But this move by first Chrysler and then General Motors, as it spreads out across the country, people are all of a sudden going to realize, oh, this isn't so good. I mean, because I was listening to Tamaroff today because he got closed. Typical Dodge dealer, 55 employees, and they've got nowhere to go. But he said it's not just that. It's just, we have a lot of little suppliers that supply us. And that's going to be the story all across the country. And the real estate thing you brought up, Eddie, is interesting because a lot of these towns depend on dealers for tax revenue. So, it's going to be painful. It has to be done. But, other than that, I don't know how we're going to get around this.
One note, though, on the turnover at these dealerships that have about 50 employees. And I've been a big cheerleader for the dealers, and I have a lot of dealer friends. Most of those people are going to be picked up at other dealerships. Remember that in this industry, at the auto dealer level, both on the sales side and the technician side, there's incredible turnover. These guys are moving almost like Mexican construction workers. Somebody shows up and says, we'll give you a dollar more.
Particularly in the sales side.
That's right, and they'll move. So those shops as we close this one and get more business, sales and service, there's a shortage, by the way, of technicians.
Has been
so,
a long time.
Yeah, for a long time. And so they'll find a job. Most, though, of these dealers that are going away, about 83% of them sold more used cars than new.
Exactly.
In fact, Peter, last week I mentioned the automotive news story showing this poor dealer who was being screwed by Chrysler 4 years ago. The fact is he still had Plymouth on his sign. He sold one new car, in that year before. All of it was used. Used is okay, but don't use the brand of the car maker. A couple of years ago, Starbucks had to get rid of many franchises because they had too many. Nobody really pitched a bitch because, they're Starbucks. We have to do this. It's more painful because these are higher paying jobs. But I think when we come out of the end of this snake, a smaller dealer body, which they all wanted, and every dealer will tell you they wanted a smaller dealer body, I'm very positive on that, despite the pain that's going to cause some communities. And you're right on the environmental side. We're going to have some of these eyesore dealerships empty, especially the ones that have been there 50 or 60 years, where we have to remediate the soil and stuff like that. It's going to be, you can't sell that crap for a while.
Yeah.
So a lot of ugly and layers of ugliness.
Especially the ground under the service area bathroom. You don't want that.
Yeah, ones where your family has been, Eddie.
But one of the biggest one of the biggest advantages of this, or we really should say improvements, is that when you have dealers doing the kind of low volume they have, and they're competing with somebody 2 miles away on a car, and they're giving away all of the gross, the salesman's commission is based on that gross. And if you're getting paid, and I've seen numbers as low as this, $50 to move a Chevy, and that's your commission because the gross is getting eaten away because there's too much competition. How motivated are you as a salesman to really work it if that's all you're getting? And number two, what's the quality of salespeople they're getting? I mean, as soon as somebody becomes a hot salesman at a Chevy or, say, a Ford or Chrysler showroom, the commissions are so much lower because of the price competition that they move on to an import dealership where the volumes are higher and they can make a lot more money. So the dealers that survive will be able to retain good salespeople much more easily. I mean, you know, eventually we'll see, once it all the dust settles here, we'll see much stronger dealers.
The car's been the lowest profit margin piece of the whole puzzle for a long time at the domestics.
Yeah. Well, this is going to take years to shake out. I mean, once GM starts closing their dealers, this is going to be a five-year process. I don't know if we have 5 years, but let's shift gears a little bit. This week, the Auto Industry Task Force ordered Chrysler to cut their advertising budget in half. Now, I get the argument out there, so before you flame me in a million, like, laser beams, I get the argument that once the car companies take money, then they're beholden to their overseers. I bristle at this because you've got people who don't understand the first thing about marketing or advertising arbitrarily saying, nah, that's too much money. You got to cut that in half. What do you guys think? What do you think, David?
Well, you know, I've written a couple of stories about how deeply the task force and their hired guns are in at General Motors in terms of, you know, teeing up. And it's healthy to tee up questions, but, you know, teeing up questions in a way that also brings pressure to get rid of, say, GMC and Buick. And, you know, the one on GMC was you know, particularly silly. I mean, here's a brand that gets 2,000 to 4,000 more per vehicle than the comparable Chevrolet. So you're given, an average transaction price. Yeah. So you're giving away a, you know, brand that sells a pricier product. Number two, the second choice for GMC Sierra buyers is not a Chevy Silverado. It's an F-150. So you're going to get market share loss if you just get rid of a brand that, by the way, was carrying its own weight. So I don't like government just arbitrarily, you know, taking a bigger hand in big business decisions like this. At the same time, most of the Treasury Department's moves so far, forcing GM to cut deeper in terms of debt, get their labor costs in line, and go farther than either of Wagoner's plans did. So far, it's mostly been good stuff. Now, this decision with Chrysler's marketing budget, I don't like at all. The only counter-argument I'd give to it is, and I've heard this argument from some smart people, is that if you have a great car right now and you're bringing it to market, you're going to have to relaunch it in 2 years because nobody's buying right now anyways. So do you really want to blow out on marketing at a time when nobody's buying? And by the way, their plants are shut down anyways.
That's what the judge said.
Yeah.
You aren't making anything, why do you need to advertise?
Now I don't. I mean, I understand that argument. Now, I don't buy it because the thing that has really been sort of underplayed in this whole, you know, morass of restructuring and bankruptcy talk and government loan talk over the past 6-7 months is the revenue side here. Everyone talks about cut this, cut that, but no one's really talking about how they're going to turn around in terms of starting to really sell, keep market share, and build revenue. Even in a bad market, you still got to ring the register.
Yeah. What do you think, Eddie?
Well, I think that David's exactly right. You know, without product, there's no money coming in. And look at Chrysler's situation right now. If those small Fiats prove workable in the U.S., they're still 20 months away, best case scenario. And, you know, it's I think, like David said, you have to move metal. And look at who's gaining share right now. It's the people who are sticking to their plan, like Hyundai. Hyundai's
Ford
kind
even.
Of,
Audi has increased its marketing budget in the U.S. 20% this year, figuring everyone else is going to cut back. And when others cut back, there's less noise, and your advertising and marketing is just heard that much more loudly. You can really get some attention.
It's a snowball effect, yeah. So I agree with you, David.
Well, what do you have to say?
I believe the Auto Task Force has kidnapped the President of the United States because they went to him and said, we want them to decrease their advertising and their marketing. And Obama said, decrease advertising and marketing. That's not my game, baby.
Yeah.
And I think it's crazy. I think with, what have you been saying, Peter, the B&B words?
You're bad and bankruptcy.
It's going out there, and you've got to tell the people that you're in business, the benefits of your vehicle, you got great vehicles, and keep cheering it on, whether it's PR or marketing, and spending all of your money there. And not decrease it by 50%, perhaps double up.
Yeah, I'm absolutely there, and I wrote about it this week. And, you know, obviously I come from an advertising background, so I sort of believe in it. However, when times are bad like this, you can't hide, you know, hide in the bushes over there and hope it all goes. You got to come out, and you got to promote, you got to advertise. If anything, we've seen GM be reduced to this deal advertising. You know, GM has the best products lineup in their history, and you would never know it.
You know, there's a real problem here.
And I just generally, you got to spend money right now.
I've talked to people at GM about this, and I did a story on it. I basically said, look, you guys are getting pilloried here. Why aren't you out there more in public, either with PR, marketing, advertising, a whole package, saying we've got some great products, we're still in business? And one of the answers was, we're afraid that people are going to bitch that we're spending government money on marketing. And I'm like, but you got to run the business. And you know what? I'm sorry, to the people in the American public who are going to complain that a company taking government money is advertising and doing public relations, I'm sorry, that's part of running a business. You don't sell stuff without advertising it. You don't sell stuff without your flax up there on camera and in the press talking and getting really aggressive. You know, if our elected officials decided they're going to loan money or take shares in a company, even if we don't like it, during the time that that decision is being executed, you've got to let them do what it takes to make the companies really work and succeed.
Well, absolutely. And in Chrysler's case, now, you know, everyone says, you know, they're looking at their watches saying, well, 24 months, 22 months, these new Fiats, it's going to be great. Hey, you have to be in business now. And that's the one thing that's the disconnect with the auto task force that I have a problem with. It's just like, hey, guys, that's cool. You got a lot of good ideas. You're bringing a lot of good ideas to this business, blah, blah, blah. But you have to let us sell what we have on the ground right now.
When the 300 got really hot at the beginning, we spent zero, basically. Yeah, a few shekels, but mostly in Chrysler brand advertising. We basically spent zero on 300 advertising because you didn't have to. The word was out there. It was good. That tells you the story. When times are bad, you go the inverse.
And, you know, David brought up Audi. I mean, Audi has stayed focused. They've got, you know, Johann de Nijsen's done a tremendous job. They've stayed focused on their mission, and they haven't wavered. And now their product is catching up to their message, and they're linking together, and all of a sudden, look where Audi is. Audi is just, you know.
Yeah, and when I talked to Johann about this, he made a really good point to me. He said, this isn't just about, you know, having a bunch of great ads and during, you know, sporting events on Saturday and Sunday and selling cars Monday through Friday. He said, we know the market's bad. We know that every ad we run and every move we make isn't going to result in big sales numbers this year because people aren't shopping. But we're talking about long-term brand building that's 2, 3, 5 years out. You know, we've created awareness and we've cast, you know, in the eyes of the public what our brand is going to be. And, you know, let's face it, a lot of these domestic brands that we're talking about here tonight with GM and Chrysler and even Ford, for that matter, they've got long-term brand rebuilding and image work to do that's going to take several years. And, hey, man, you know, no time to start like the present.
Yeah, well, that's one thing. Since I started doing Auto Extremists, I always, you know, the Detroit automakers notoriously have never taken the long view. It's always been the 30-day mentality. And that's where the Asians and the European manufacturers, you know, handed them their lunch because they had this long view, where Detroit was, you know, it's like 30 days, what have you done with this lately?
Particularly Honda.
Yeah, Honda's stayed focused. Now we're seeing Audi doing it. And so, long-term brand building, unfortunately, who knows what kind of time this business has. And by the way, if any of you eligible advertisers out there would love to support AutoLine After Hours, this is a great place to drop a bunch of money.
And, build your brand.
And our chat people would go out and buy your products. It'd be wonderful. Maybe not. All right. So, all right, let's shift gears. How about Sergio Marchionne neatly removing his Fiat people from the salary guidelines. I thought that was slick.
That was special.
Yeah.
pure genius.
Yeah.
If you want to attract the best and brightest, you don't want to come into an environment where, okay, the CEO can get $500,000, and I know viewers out there will go, Jesus, that's a lot of money. Maglio or Donis of the Tigers is having a crappy year and it's making $15 million.
Well, here's the thing, Jason. You know, look at kind of the history of pay and industry in America, and look at what we attracted in terms of talent and quality and minds in the 50s and 60s, you know, like the Whiz Kids, Robert McNamara. He didn't turn out so great, but, you know, the guy's a genius. And think about where they went after that. And they went to California in the 70s and 80s to make computers. And then in the 90s and the aughts, they went to Wall Street. So we keep getting knocked further and further down. I don't think a salary cap is such a great idea if you want to attract people who can solve this problem.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Let's.
Well, what's the Italian translation for he's crafty?
Got to respect the Bing, man. How about the implosion of Toyota? Here is a company. I wrote a book called The United States of Toyota about, you know, the emergence of the decline of the U.S. and the emergence of Toyota and the world domination. Funny thing happened on the way to world domination. They had $36 billion in their war chest, 24 months ago?
Yep.
Yeah.
And it was like by far the most of any automaker. And now it's gone.
What are they down to? 10?
No, it's not that low, because they liquidated
12?
Some securities.
Let's just say it's not good.
Yeah, it's diminished. And the I mean, look, they've still got enough money to weather the storm. The thing I found most odd is at the press conference, Watanabe said that they still don't think they need to close any plants and do any sort of permanent restructuring. I mean, you know, shuttering them temporarily,
that's
of course doing, but that's why they're burning money, is because they're still paying the workers.
Well, that's why he got yanked.
To polish doorknobs and do Kaizen work. you know, we'll see what Akio Toyoda, the scion of the founder, is going to do when he takes over in July. Is he going to put up with this level of losses? Because they lost $4.4 billion, and they're saying they're going to lose $5.5 billion this current fiscal year.
Didn't they actually lose more than GM?
In the quarter.
Yeah,
they lost
in the quarter. Yeah,
they lost
quarter.
More than $7.7 billion in the quarter, which was more than GM. And, hey, you know, Honda made money last year.
Honda will make money on Armageddon Day.
They have a depression mentality.
It's one of my favorite car companies. I've always loved Honda. I always like the fact that it's the Honda Motor Company,
because
they're all about motors. So, you know, it's always been a favorite. But, boy, the downward spiral of Toyota has just been dramatic.
Here's one of the perils of the Toyota way, right? You know, never invent, just innovate. Never go first into a market. Look at how they rushed in after the domestics into SUVs, and look at how many flanks they had exposed because of it.
Look, you compare Honda to Toyota. This is why Toyota is where they are.
Yeah.
They overexpanded like crazy. You know, they've got the truck plant in San Antonio, which is heavily underutilized. They have in Mississippi a Prius plant that's supposed to open. The building's done, but there's no machinery in there. There's no tooling, or it's a hollow building. And they're sort of, I called them the other day, and they don't have an answer on when they're going to open yet, because Priuses aren't moving and nothing else is for that matter. So, you know, they've got several plants underutilized and one that they hope to fill with something someday, but there's no demand. You know, they still have the "we built it so they will come" mentality. And, you know, we'll see how long their shareholders and the new CEO are going to be with this level of losses.
To an avid viewer of Autoline After Hours, Senator Richard Shelby, I hope you're hearing this. You know, as you said, everybody in Detroit was stupid.
That asshole.
We don't allow that word except except five or six times during the show.
Well, you know, Toyota, while they were making their shiny, happy Priuses, they were making their money on SUVs. And, of course, the green intelligentsia didn't want to hear that, but that was the reality. But let's enough about Toyota. I propose this for our duh of the week. This is the Free Press headline in today's paper. GM fears U.S. control could hurt in long run. Do you think? I mean, hey, you know, we've been on this. Can you get? Oh, yeah, you got it.
And guess right next to the photo of the Biggest Loser, who's from Michigan?
Yeah,
that's a Midwestern paper for you.
But I mean, you know, we've debated about government involvement, you know, but you know the fact that you know GM is a bit concerned about the government having 50% control of the company and whether or not they could, you know, it's going to hurt. Of course it's going to hurt. I mean, you know, it's kind of like this circular argument. Well, a lot of readers send email to me and say, oh, you know, we should have let them just fail on December 31st. We'd be a lot better off. The other side of that argument is if we had let them fail on December 31st, I don't think we'd be talking about what we're talking about now. I think we'd be talking about...
Yeah, you know what I don't get about that mentality?
Talking about what?
A much worse economy than it is now?
Totally.
Yeah, I mean...
You look who's fighting now for GM plants to stay open. Corker. Carper.
Yeah.
These guys. All the stuff.
Because all of a sudden it's, oh, now you get it. Okay.
Right.
Now all of a sudden, well, it's my plant. Now, wait a minute. You know, it's okay for everybody else. Now all of a sudden it's my plant in Tennessee and, hey, hands off.
Oh, it's not a Detroit thing. It's not a Michigan thing. It's Tennessee. Oh, God, it's California.
Yeah, all of a sudden it's an American
thing. North Carolina.
Thing.
It's Alabama.
The thing that the CEOs failed to do when they went to Capitol Hill was describe the multiplier effect.
The CEOs, that was such a, oh, God, it was a disaster.
Weren't you waiting for, like, Lutz or somebody to storm in there Howard Hughes style?
Well,
sadly.
Yeah. the fact that they should have had Lutz. If I was calling the shots at GM, I said, you know what,
they
Bob?
They had Lutz under wraps at the time.
Absolutely. But you know what? There would have been a soundbite that would have been priceless. The only soundbite to come out of those hearings is, you guys flew down here in your jets. And, you know, and where was the other side of that argument was saying, oh, should we talk about the fact that when Nancy Pelosi became speaker, she wasn't happy with her jet, so they had to get her a 757.
57.
So she could fly to California nonstop.
Does it have a plastic surgery OR on the thing?
Well,
Daddy, I like your addition to this show.
You are correct, sir.
David?
Yeah, the hypocrisy was unbelievable, but the presentation from the big three CEOs was also really terrible.
Horrible.
I mean, and what I don't get about that is I talked to the PR people at the companies before these guys went down there, and they told me they knew they were going to get hammered. And how they went down there and still got hammered, not knowing what the game was. I mean, it was a really tough assignment to go down there.
Well, yeah, but
knowing how much animosity there is in a lot, many parts of the country.
Well, the timing was bad. It was at the tail end of, you know, the whole country had heard about this big implosion of the financial industry. The timing was horrible. But in classic PR style, they were all coached. Can't get rattled.
Right.
You can't show any emotion. You can't. You know, be careful not to show any disgust. And, well, the problem with that is then all of a sudden the American public think these guys are comatose. I would have much rather have a Lutz sitting there now, wait a minute, Senator. I'd rather see that soundbite.
Yeah.
Lutz getting in their face. Now, wait a minute. I'm going to tell you what this industry means to this country, and you're going to listen.
Can you imagine Bob?
But no, it was hat in hand. It was horrible.
Imagine Bob looking at the Senator going, excuse me, you're a retardo butt.
Okay, but what's the best way to get your point across is to have somebody who's not you tell you and support it. What they really should have done, I think, is something more orchestrated where they got politicians from the areas where they have plants and tell those guys, okay, if we go down, you could lose X number of jobs from that plant, plus all these parts makers, plus all of these dealers in the area.
They didn't want to hear it, but now they're seeing it. They didn't want to hear it, now they're seeing it.
And the bottom line is that durable goods manufacturing is the engine of this country, and there's no two ways about it.
And I've been
it sounds, totally simplistic and stupid, but you either pull it out of the ground or you take rubber and steel and glass and turn it into a $20,000 Malibu. That's how you create wealth. How else are you going to do it?
Well,
pizzas to each other?
Part of this that has really less to do with Detroit, more to do with the American mentality, and it gets into why people haven't really cared much about the car makers, is, let's face it, for the past decade and probably going into the 90s, making stuff in a dirty factory was something for low-wage Asians and Mexicans. We Westerners, we don't have to do that kind of dirty stuff because we've got this intellectual economy where we create software and iPods and derivatives and credit default swaps and we do financial engineering because we're so damn smart and everybody else can do that manual labor with their bodies. That's not work for more advanced societies. And we sort of concentrated our economic focus on Wall Street and Silicon Valley, and that's why in the heart of the country where there's manufacturing and farming, nobody cares about it because that's sort of yesteryear's economy.
Yeah, they don't.
And now we're realizing that the tech bubble burst in the early part of the decade, and now we have a financial meltdown. Oh, wait a minute. We can't just rely on tech and finance because, the economy becomes lopsided, and by the way, none of those guys knew what they were doing.
Yeah, the gradual...
Right.
The gradual
go ahead,
Eddie.
I just came back from the Shanghai Auto Show, and 10 years ago, that place was a rice paddy. Now it looks like Orange County. I mean, there's faux Tuscan buildings, and there's Starbucks and KFC and Panera Bread. There's a 3 Series on every corner. Those guys are doing in 10 years what it took us 100 years to do.
And there's going to be an Athens Coney Island there soon.
What?
There's going to be an Athens Coney Island there soon.
I'll take you, Pete.
You just never know.
No, but I mean, where do they get that money?
Well, yeah, the erosion of the American manufacturing base is the underlying story in all this and something I've been writing about since last fall. I took a lot of hits for it, but the reality is that's what this is about. This country just doesn't exist on buying and selling air. We have to make things. And if we lose that either ability or appreciation, well, we've already lost the appreciation for it. Now all of a sudden it's like, people are trying to think, yeah, well, just like you said, maybe we ought to, get back to making stuff and selling stuff.
But Eddie's right. That's how you create wealth. You take raw materials and you add value through engineering and designing something somebody wants to buy.
Now we're going to get back to it, but it's going to be painful.
I wrote my column about that for the July issue. I know I'm going to get hammered. But, why not take all these blown out, uninhabited exurbs, these, subdivisions, they're going to be the meth labs of the future, the slums of the future.
Yeah.
Build a factory nearby, make whatever the hell you want to make, give people free room and board, have them build stuff. All their money would be disposable income. It would go back in the economy. We'd have manufacturing in this country again. But you have to change the economics of it because, people are not going to get paid a Chinese wage here unless you take care of them.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the inverse of what Henry Ford did.
Yeah. So on that note, what do you think about GM being the first company to import cars from China for sale in the U.S. market? Good move or necessary move?
I think actually a good move. I mean, I do believe in a global economy. I believe if you're selling there, you should take advantage of manufacturing there and bring it here. It looked like 3 years ago Chrysler was going to be the first company with Chery, and that Chery was not Chery.
It crashed in Russia someplace.
Yeah.
That goes under the file of not so much.
Yeah. I think it will happen. I mean, think about it. The North American Auto Show, we saw some of the Chinese vehicles. They were crap.
Yeah.
They're going to need Western technology, our Western technology and manufacturing to get them up to speed. That's why GM sells so many cars in China right now, because the Chinese cars are still crap. They will get better, and eventually some will be sold here, and others will bring cars in from China. The Japanese may be the last to bring cars from China here.
What's scary is Geely at Shanghai was launching 22 new cars. And unlike the Yak carts that they showed at Detroit 2 years ago, these things had decent fit and finish. And that was scary to me.
Yeah, but it's at a show, right? So they probably brought in George P. Johnson or somebody else.
Right.
They probably couldn't raise a hood because they were wired down with screws and wire, and they looked tight. Let's see what these guys can do in real production vehicles, because I still believe they're a couple years away. But we do need a global economy. I'm a firm believer of that, or maybe I'm just a stupid Republican.
Let's not forget the backside of the story, which is that the UAW complained to the Treasury Department saying that basically they ought to reject GM's current restructuring plan because they want to close 16 factories while amping up production in China. And Fritz Henderson told Bloomberg TV today that they may pull back on their planned expansion in China for export to get a deal done with the UAW. So, this is one of those stories you can read about on GM.gov, which is, you got the union going to an administration, or a labor-friendly administration, while they're all in the middle of this sort of shuttle diplomacy to get a big restructuring plan done, and then Henderson says he's going to back off. And again, this is what we get back to with the problem with government ownership or government, at least partial control or government influence, whatever you want to call it, on the company, is they're not allowed to make smart business decisions. What does Toyota do? They've got plants in Japan, and when the Japanese market gets soft, they export more cars here.
Yeah.
And when the Japanese market gets hot again, and sales rise here, then they start building plants here. But they can flex all right. As long as you can sell the cars from one market to another, you can flex and you can keep your global footprint. You can keep those plants running full tilt, and that's how you make money in this business. You keep your plants running at 100% or better, and if you don't, you bleed like a pig. And, they got to let them do that.
GM Japan supplants its workforce there by selling in this market in good times. Wouldn't the UAW like GM to sell and work throughout the world to supplant their workers here? Act like Toyota has acted.
I got a super scribbler saying a bit too early to dance on Toyota's grave. We're not dancing on Toyota's grave. And not by any stretch. We're just pointing out that, they're in a bit of a bad patch.
Yes.
It's like in the movie My Blue Heaven when Steve Martin keeps saying, and Barney, he has problems too.
You know what? That was one of the shittiest Steve Martin movies of all time. So, all right, we're 3 minutes away.
Yeah, okay, one more thing. What do you guys think about the possibility of GM moving their headquarters out of the Rensen? I've narrowed it down to three options. One, they're going to move to Warren, where they were going to originally move before they bought the Rensen. Two, they're going to sell the Rensen and then stay there and just, occupy like one-third of the space. And then the other option was to move like to Carolina or the South or Texas or whatever. What do you guys think of that?
Suburban Virginia?
Yeah, next to Audi. All the Audi guys, we just left Detroit. They're coming back?
I was thinking like next to the CIA office in Langley.
Oh, okay.
They put too much money into it, but that's not the excuse. It's a horrible building, but it is a symbol. The new administration in Detroit will make sure, just like they need a new Cobo, they need to keep GM there. They will. Fouts, the mayor of Warren, he's looking out for his constituencies. He's actually been a pretty politically savvy and PR-savvy guy. He kind of stepped on it this week.
Mm-hmm. He's really the one who started the whole story.
Yeah, he really did. He led the rumor. GM will stay in the Rensen, period. And no way will they move out of Michigan. No way.
Although, the thing is, though, hang on. Fritz Henderson didn't exactly bat that back the following Monday when we pressed him on it.
He couldn't.
Why not? No, we're not leaving Detroit. How hard is that to say?
Say never. You never say never, because then you guys, you scumbags in the media, would skewer him. You said you'd never do this.
But if he's never going to leave, why is that a problem?
Because you never know. It could become so dire that you have to. You have to move into a trailer park in Melvindale.
My take on this is,
what they got to do with it is sell a pay-per-view thing where they blow it up like a Vegas hotel. That building ruined the riverfront. They asked Al Taubman, after they built that thing 30 years ago or whatever, after they broke ground, what he thought of it. And he said, it's a great building, but it's a quarter mile too close to the river. Mm-hmm. And it totally shuts off the river. It puts the cities back to the river. I mean, we should have a Chicago or Cleveland-style waterfront. We don't.
Yeah, okay.
Fifth man here.
Yeah, it's time for, we need to move on, as they say.
So you have to comment on this, because you're the guy that called it the tubes, down the tubes.
Yes, I did name, we did name them the tubes, and we are going to, but we are going to switch over to rapid fire now, and this is where we get your questions and comments, and we comment on them in a minute or less, and shall we bring the questions in?
Bring it.
Got to run the promo, though.
That's great. Is that from Duke Nukem or something?
Yeah, the highest tech graphics in the history of
me. Shows you how long it's been since I played.
Okay, now Jason's going to read these, and then...
this is my one job I have on the show.
And then we have to say who's asking them, and then we try to comment. Just so you know, Eddie, this is so we try to do it in a minute or less or whatever.
We put a timer on. So yeah. Here we go. This is from Mike Korshin emailing us saying, why doesn't Chrysler just go all the way and drop all their dealers, then follow the retail structure that sells big ticket items like refrigerators? In other words, sell the cars through everyone who sells refrigerators, such as Walmart, Home Depot, Lowe's, and local retail chains that might sell furniture. 1 minute, please.
Go ahead.
Mr. Welch, go.
We've heard this before with selling cars at,
big box.
Kohl's or, whatever.
Costco.
The problem is we're getting rid of dealers. We're not looking for more retail outlets.
Yeah.
Eddie?
Yeah, I think, you're probably going to see Saturn move to something like that, but I don't think it's going to be a full big box retail experience where you got appliances and everything in there. I think it'll be probably a mix of brands. But no, I think that the dealership experience is important. It builds trust. Look at what Lexus was able to do.
Yeah, I don't think it's a good way to go. I don't think it's going to solve anything.
When I was back at Ford in 2000, 2001, the big thinkers were saying, this is the way of the car industry. You go in, you look at the SUV aisle, and they weren't that big of thinkers after all. So
was that Jacques?
It wasn't. No, he was against it, too, because the franchise law. All right, let's start with a minute and a second. Via email, Stephen Wade asks us this. Who would you like to see take Saab over in the future? Who do you think will take over Saab?
I think Saab should go back to being the regional brand that we used to see college professors drive in the Northeast. Whoever can accomplish that. I don't think it was ever a national brand here. I like Saabs, don't get me wrong. But I don't know who could take it over other than somebody with a Swedish accent who understands it. Although the Chinese are probably going to get it.
I think Saab should be owned by the same guy who has the rights to Studebaker, Nash, Packard, Graham, and Hudson. Look, one of the big problems in this cataclysmic time we've seen is that despite all the excess capacity, we have too many brands and too many companies selling too many cars. No one's died. Nobody's being taken out here. I've heard arguments that Mitsubishi should go and Chrysler should go and Saab and all these other brands should go away, but nobody's leaving, so we still have too many companies, too many brands.
What do you think, Eddie? Agree?
Yeah, I agree.
All right, we can move off this one.
All right, we're off of Saab. Let's let it go down to empty. Comment from guest. Given the 381-day supply of Chrysler vehicles, how steeply discounted do you think the cars will eventually be during the height of the fire sale days later this year? Eddie, your kids are home. I'll start this one. I think they're going to be steeply discounted at the dealerships that are closing because Chrysler's not going to take them back. These dealers, these vehicles are like produce at your grocery store. They're going to start rotting on the dealership. So if you're a consumer, you go to the government site to see what dealerships are closing, and you wait about a week, you want to buy a very good car. Go and get it, and you're going to get it. It's going to be a fire sale.
Yeah, there's. I agree. There's going to be a fire sale.
Yeah, and some of the dealers, the surviving dealers, are going to buy some of that inventory, and they're going to get it dirt cheap because they don't need cars right now, but they'll take it because they're going to buy it so cheap, and they can sell it and make a good dime on it. Huge deals.
Right.
Eddie?
I was trying to close the door behind me when you were asking that question, so
I've got no idea. It's okay. We got it covered, Eddie.
Okay, good.
Okay.
Jesus Chrysler asks, how can less dealers give better service? Isn't it the other way around? I think that's kind of not right. A dealer gives good service or not. And if they get more business, they can improve their bays, they can improve everything around the part of the business that gets the most money in and out the door. And you'll see it. The dealerships that are the finest dealerships that have put the money in their service area, it's not a matter of quantity of dealers, it's the quality of the dealership. And if they get more business, they're going to only get better.
Yeah, I think it's really a product of the mentality of the ownership of the dealer. They either believe in it or they don't.
And let's face it, if the dealers are more profitable, they can have porters to drive you to and from work. They can give you more loaner cars. They can do stuff like when your car's 3 months off warranty, but you know, a $1,200 brake job comes up, they can cover that for you because they got some extra cash to make you happy. Yeah. Service gets better when dealers make money.
Exactly. And not everybody comes in on the same day.
Right. Go ahead.
Okay. Inline 6 asks, how exactly did Lutz and Wagoner ruin GM? I'd be interested to hear a reasonable explanation.
Oh, man.
Oh, boy.
Eddie,
this is called rapid fire. Go ahead.
You know,
Eddie.
I disagree 100%. I think the sad part about it is what happened to GM is what happened to Oldsmobile. It's what happened to Pontiac. They finally got their act together, and now they're screwed. And, you know, it's a long process to fix a company like this. And I think Lutz was starting from the top with Halo cars, and he was moving through. And I think the guy put tremendous emphasis on quality. And guys like Dave Rand made a great case for quality in those cars. And I do not accept that premise.
I think Lutz actually did a very good job. I mean, GM has the best product in its history right now, and he was dealt a really tough hand because he had to try to do that over 8 brands and, you know, 60-some models. Wagoner, look, he was making the right decisions, just too late.
Yeah.
And not far enough, but he also was handed, you know, decades worth of problems.
Yeah, and Bob's done a tremendous job, and hopefully spoke with Bob, and he might be a guest on Autoline After Hours pretty soon.
We look forward to that. Here's Bad Nickel on Twitter asks, GM leaves Detroit, not yet, by the way, Bad Nickel, and GM CEOs ditch stock. Why should taxpayers help them? 200 GM executives this week sold their stock options, when the stock was down to about $1.15. Knowing it's probably going to go down to zero. Is that wrong?
No, it's not wrong. I mean, it's soon to be worthless. It's part of their compensation. And by the way, I mean, you know, the company hasn't been performing, so any options that they've gotten have, you know, aren't worth a plug nickel. A lot of the bonuses that they, you know, that they were in line to get or at least were part of their compensation package they couldn't cash in on because the company isn't hitting certain targets. You know, let them cash out. I mean, the stock's not going to be worth anything anyways. I don't understand why it's an issue, frankly.
Yeah.
Eddie?
I agree.
Yeah, I agree with David. You know what?
If you've ever been an auto executive that I have, whether you're the man or the woman, when you go home to your spouse and you haven't cashed out your stock when it's going to go to zero anyway and it's worth $1.05, you're not screwed. Trust me. John Wills, one of our chat modes, asked, 2 weeks into the Chrysler bankruptcy, how do you think things are proceeding? Will Chrysler be back in production in 4 weeks or less? Peter?
No. I think it's going to take a little longer. I think as far as how it's proceeding, I think it is what it is. I don't think there's anything like a high-fiving going on about the process. But I think it's going to take longer than people think to really get this thing done.
Pete, how long would you estimate? How long do you think this will be tied up?
Another 45 to 60 days.
That's about right. It has gone actually pretty well so far. I mean, the dissenting creditors have sort of been exposed as a bunch of blowhards, and Judge Arthur Gonzalez didn't have it. He let them go through the procedure. I think they got a fair hearing, but he didn't really have too much time for them. So you know, that, and that was a big, tough issue, and I, it's not officially done yet, but I think it's pretty much cleared.
Yeah.
By all accounts, this is going through as faster than every person expected, and I think they're going to come out the end of this snake still with a lot of work to do, as a journal reported. This is going to be the bad crap's going to take a while, but they're going to be willing to go forward. Autoline Daily producer Craig Cole asks, Peter, how did you get a full-size auto-extremist billboard at Road America?
I've been going to Road America since 1967, and it is my absolutely all-time favorite place to go see a race. And I actually pay for the two billboards, actually, out of my own pocket, well, out of auto-extremist pockets. And I just do it out of love of the track. And one board up there is real popular because I call Road America America's National Park of Speed, and now Road America is going to use that tagline with my good graces. So it's just one of these I love the place type thing.
Back with Jesus Chrysler, why hasn't the GM board of directors all been canned at this point?
Well, they're on the way to being canned.
Yeah.
And right now it's inconsequential.
Yeah.
There's bigger fish to fry because they're right. Not in control.
And the majority that, frankly, probably supported Rick are going to be gone anyhow.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rumors of the auto extremists being appointed to the GM board have not been denied as of yet.
Stratablog on Twitter asks, will GM shareholders really get 1 cent on the dollar for their investment? It's an intellectual insult.
That's my buddy Tino in Toronto, Italian paisan in Toronto, and he's really mad at GM.
All right, we've really run out our questions, so let's move on in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, we can go a little longer. Let's see. Oh, I've got a rapid response. Hyundai is bringing over this $75,000 Equus sedan and to display at their dealers, and just kind of putting their toe in the water. Can they go to this level? What do you guys think about, are they premature? Are they on target with where Hyundai's with their progression?
Let me ask a question on that first. Is Equus Korean for Phaeton?
But another thing. Try the prime rib, folks. It's wonderful.
It's way premature. They haven't proven that they can sell the Genesis yet, and that's, what, half the price?
There it is. Boy, we're on top of it, I got to tell
you. So, Hyundai's done some great things, and I think they've become the leader in automotive merchandising, coming up with a 100,000-mile warranty first, and then the assurance program first that other companies have copied. They're tapped into what sells cars in this market, and the product has gotten very good, but they're not ready to sell $75,000.
But the takeoff on the assurance spot was classic. Have you seen that on
No.
Oh, that's been floating around. It's just hilarious. What do you think, Eddie?
Yeah, I agree. I would be wary of pushing too far too fast. You know, let them get a foothold. Let them, you know, see how this experiment with the Genesis goes, and then push up market.
But seriously, if Volkswagen couldn't sell a Phaeton, and their brand commands better pricing than Hyundai does, if they can't sell a Phaeton, how are they going to sell an Equus at that price?
You're right. Be good at what you can do and get so good that you can naturally go to the next level. And right now, Americans in general, speaking of the American market, will not accept a vehicle with two U's in the name. It's just too hard.
By the way, who's going to pay $75,000 for a Hyundai badge? Now,
the beauty of the Hyundai is you get Toyota level, you get Honda level, you get GM level at $15,000 less.
Yeah.
It's the classic screw-up that Kmart did versus Walmart. It's forgetting your space in the world and being the best you can at the space, much like Honda is.
Yeah.
And then possibly venturing on once you get so much credibility, so much in the bank, but to go so fast, so far, you could screw yourself.
Well, you can't buy credibility with a $75,000 car. You can only lose it.
No, but it kind of goes with the Hyundai mentality, corporate mentality. I mean, they burn through American executives like, you know, about one a year, and they're always pushing, and, you know, they don't quite get it, you know, really what they should be doing in this market. So they ought to really go real slow on this idea. I think they're 5 years, 7 years, 8 years, 10 years.
Kravchuk's been good.
Look at Acura. Acura still doesn't have its sea legs, even though its core brand is great, and they've taken forever to develop that brand.
I would argue Infiniti too is not, you know, they've
still not there.
Yeah, they really haven't. They're both solidly second tier luxury brands, and a pretty long walk to being upper tier.
And
they've been at it for quite a while.
And they built those brands around the smaller cars, you know, the high volume $35,000 to $40,000 cars.
Yeah. Hey, Eddie, David Welch is driving a Q5. Have you driven that yet?
I drove a Q5 TDI. I loved it.
What are you driving? That's not a TDI.
No. But it's
you like
it's
it?
A 3.2. Yeah, it's a great vehicle. I mean, Audi's got some great stuff these days. They're doing a nice job.
Yeah. So where are we at, Chip? Are we?
But
you can wrap up.
Okay.
Yeah, because you know what? I want to watch the Wings.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah, we are. Right. Apologize to non-Detroit Red Wing fans, but we got a game going on. So we're wrapping up this show, and we appreciate everyone for tuning in. And John will be back at his on his throne next week, and I'm sure the show will be much better. But in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/autoline, twitter.com/carandriver, twitter.com/autoextremists. And David Welch is on Twitter, but we don't have his Twitter thing here.
I'm not even sure what it is. I just signed up.
Okay. You can find it. And
I think it's just David Welch, all one word.
Okay. And
David Welch at Craigslist.com.
But not the adult list.
Eddie, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good talking to you guys.
Thanks, Eddie.
And let's get together soon.
Yeah. That sounds great.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Outoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Outoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at outoflinedetroit.tv.
Orange, purple, silver, and blue, change of frequency.